Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 27th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We're delighted to be joined today by two guests. We've got Andre Volcek, who's going to be talking about
The Philippines.
Excellent. And we've also got David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives with us. And we're going to be back on the subject, the perilous state of Britain's defences. Over to you, Mike.
Yeah, let's get straight on with the Philippines, ISIS in the Philippines. So on the 23rd of May, I believe it was, the Philippine Army entered the southern city of Marawi in the southern Philippines, because the local, Andre, you can correct me on the pronunciation of this, but the Mighty Extremist Group instigated an insurgency there, a siege, which left about 600 people dead. 400,000 people have been displaced, and some people are being held hostage in the area. Now, these extremists, according to the mainstream press at least, are backed by ISIS. And so we're going to have a look at what is actually going on there, what's the truth of the situation. So today, as Brian says, we're joined by Andre Volcek, who's a Russian-born American political analyst, journalist and filmmaker. Welcome to the programme, Andre.
Hello, nice being on your show.
So, Andre, mainstream media describes this insurgency as an ISIS insurgency. Is this group really ISIS-related, or what type of organization is this?
Okay, so basically in the Philippines, what is happening now in the south, in Marawi, the city of Marawi on the island of Mindanao is being partially occupied by the pro-ISIS, holding hostages, both Christian and Muslims, in the mosque in the center of the city. And there is a big military operation going on in the city. The army is trying to liberate the town, and there is enormous propaganda going on in the West, and also from the mainstream press in Philippines, which is owned by the big business interests, and which is basically pro-Western, which is criticizing the military of heavy-handedness, of human rights violations, and also of indiscriminate firing at the center, at the positions of the ISIS.
So President Duterte said that 100 of these ISIS fighters have escaped from the area and may be about to launch a second front. Are we really seeing almost a Syria-like situation developing in the area? Andre?
Mike, I keep losing you. I didn't hear the end of the...
Okay. So President Duterte has said that almost 100 of these fighters have managed to escape from the Marawi area, and he's suggesting that they are going to start a second front. And is this... Are we beginning to see a Syrian-type situation develop here?
I don't think so. It is very possible that approximately 100 fighters escaped from... the enclosed area of the center of Marawi, but I don't think we are going to see Aleppo or Mosul in this case. Now, let me put all this to perspective. Why do we see all these insurgents right now? Many say that President Duterte is so unpopular in the West that there is a certain attempt to destabilize his government. He's very popular president. He is now over 80% of popularity rating. When I was there, it was 75, and went up to 82. Any of these jihadi cadres that are fighting there are actually trying to destabilize the island and the state. Now, island of Mindanao was always, at least parts of it, were demanding some sort of autonomy, which they received. Some even want independence from Manila. But since Duterte came to power, there were such a great social reforms on the island, also a moratorium on mining.
Yeah.
I think in the region, attempt to improve the standard of living of the population. So many say that there is an attempt to actually use the jihadi cadres to destabilize the state and discredit or even destroy the presidency of Duterte. Now, I was on the ground. I was one of the few reporters who managed to get into the into Marawi city, and I was able to see and to what's going on, to talk to people and talk to the high military officers in Marawi. What I heard, what I learned, is that there were fighters, the ISIS fighters, who were killed. Their passports were issued in Indonesia. Their passports were issued in Malaysia and in several Arabic countries. So this is not really anymore local insurgency. This is international, you know, the war or battle with international combatants coming from the right-wing countries like Indonesia and also from the Gulf. So this is a very serious situation.
Okay. Well, look, just briefly, what influence, if any, or what interest does Russia and China have? Are they offering any support in this?
Russia recently, Russia and the Philippines recently signed the defense agreement. China is offering some military hardware because. Actually, let's put this to perspective. Philippines is had been a U.S. Colony for a certain period of time, and it is, until Duterte came to power, the country was totally dependent. Philippines were totally dependent on the United States. So all the military hardware, all the tanks, armed vehicles, even helmets were coming from the United States. There was military was trained in the United States. Military was very often corrupted. Top military brass was corrupted in the United States, and there was no independence. Now Duterte is trying to diversify this, so he's making he's dealing with Russians. He signed the defense treaty, and he's trying to reach the peace agreement with China, which is very important. And many say it's one of the reasons.
It's a difficult
attack, and under enormous propaganda, under enormous propaganda drive from the West, because actually the conflict between China and the Philippines, or China and Vietnam.
Yeah, so this
Duterte, China, the kindest nation on earth, and the good friend of Philippines, and he's trying to reach peace agreement with China. Yeah. So this is actually one of the reasons why all this is happening. So China is trying to stand, China is trying to fill the gap, the military gap, and it is providing Philippine army with some equipment, not much yet, but it is definitely going to increase if the peace agreement with China is going to be signed.
Okay, Andre, I think we'll leave it there for today. Thank you very, very much for joining us. The connection between us, you're in Beirut at the moment, is that right?
I'm in Beirut.
Yes, so the connection hasn't been fantastic, but I think the points have got across okay. So thank you for joining us, okay. And we'll speak again in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you so much, Mike. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so what were your thoughts?
Just quite fascinating, Mike. I haven't seen... I've seen a little bit, not a huge amount of this in Western media. And of course, the Philippines, such an important country for the Americans because of the vast amounts of American military equipment there, the strategic importance of the military bases. And so I can envisage that if there's any sign of slackening in support for the Americans by the local population, that there's going to be a lot of worried people. And that, of course, won't just be America. It's also going to move across into the Middle East.
David, you had some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, before this broke out, this unrest and disturbance broke out, the president there was looking for support with equipment, arms, and to deal with the drug problem. And he'd gone, Trump had said yes, but the State Department had said no. So what I understand when he was interviewed, that he got fed up with that and basically went to Russia, and Russia had said, yeah, you know, it's not a problem. What do you want? We'll sort you out. And that's how the deal was struck. And it was very, very soon after that that this unrest broke out in the country. And of course, that what you had immediately was the Philippine army and staff just went straight to America, and America came in. So you've got some overlapping stuff there, but the chronology tells you exactly what the, you know, really what the sort of what the trigger points were for this. If you just look at the sort of how it's led to this. So, you know, I think that the fact that that there was a deal struck with the Philippines and Russia for equipment and arms really says it all.
Yep. Yes. Okay. Well, look, let's move on then to other issues. Mikhail Saakashvili, long been of interest to me. I've been looking at his activities over the years in Georgia. Of course, a George Soros man through and through. And after he left Georgia, he went to the Ukraine. In 2015, he became governor of Odessa. Well, Ukraine apparently seems to have fallen out with him. What a shame. And he has had his citizenship revoked, it seems. And so he's released a press release saying, today I'm being subjected to the same approaches that are used by Ukraine's prosecutors and bureaucrats against regular Ukrainians whose rights are spat upon. This is his language. He referred to himself, as you see there, as a simple Ukrainian. But of course, Saakashvili, we've got to remember, was stripped of his Georgian citizenship in 2015 after he was appointed the governor of Odessa. He's a bit unhappy. And the problem for him is that this effectively makes him stateless. And the other problem for him is that there are several cases of embezzlement and abuse of power against him by the Georgian authorities. So he's actually wanted in Georgia at the moment. He became the president of Georgia, if you remember, in 2004, after the Soros-inspired Rose Revolution, welcomed as a stooge by Washington. He remained there until 2013. And in 2008, of course, he launched the attack on South Ossetia, which resulted in Russia getting involved and allegations against Russia of aggression from the West. So a key player in the whole anti-Russian rhetoric, and good to see him having fun at the moment.
I'll just add that somebody in the chat box has said that there's talk that Saakashvili has been fixed up with a new post in Blair's fiefdom of Albania.
Okay.
And I find that fascinating after my comments yesterday pointing people at that excellent AV8 talk about Albania.
Well, Brian, as you mentioned yesterday, of course, HMS Duncan is in Odessa at the moment, in the area, and it has visited Odessa. And I was just wondering, you know, has it gone into port to pick Saakashvili up? Perhaps it's going to deliver him to Albania. So let's keep an eye on where it goes next.
Well, it's amazing it's got there, isn't it? Presumably the water wasn't too warm for HMS Duncan.
Yes.
And in making these comments, this is no slight on the people who are actually serving on board the warships or indeed serving in the army, because the key point the UK column is making is that Britain's armed forces and personnel serving are being utterly betrayed by their government, the British government, who is not telling the truth about what is the real agenda.
Yeah. So let's have a look at this then. The Foreign Office has pushed out another little video clip, all about Australia this time. 1.2 million Britons living in Australia, more than 1 million Australians visiting Britain each year. Lots of Australians and New Zealanders working in the UK. We're closely aligned on security issues and global challenges. This is great. And of course, we're major trading partners and investors. So that's already the situation. We're already major trading partners and investors, Brian. So I wonder then why Boris Johnson is over attempting to create a new free trade deal in Australia at the moment, because we've already got free trade between ourselves and Australia. But he's over there pushing this new free trade deal. And of course, I'm just going to say it again, lots and lots of new bilateral free trade deals being created at the moment. Why? There's something different happening here? Because we've had this agreement with Australia for years, so why change it? There's people need to be paying attention to this. Let's look at what Boris had to say. He said, "I'm here to do a dirty deal with Australia to reaffirm our shared dedication to the rules-based international system that has been a guarantor of stability and, of course, also of prosperity for the last 70 years." That's a slight paraphrase, you will understand.
Yeah. So the rules-based international system, this is the key to it, identifying what this system is and what the objective is. I'll just add that I believe the Australians are calling Boris the British blonde-haired wombat.
Excellent.
Which is a bit of an insult to the wombat community.
Well, I think it is. But of course, part and parcel of this free trade agreement is and this visit is security. David's going to love this because Boris had plenty to say about the new aircraft carrier with no aircraft, the HMS Queen Elizabeth, because he's saying that as soon as it's ready to sail, it's going to sail into the South China Sea and start driving up and down past China. Here's what he said. One of the first things we will do with the new colossal aircraft carriers that we've just built is send them on a freedom of information operation.
Navigation.
Sorry,
freedom of navigation.
Freedom of
Excellent Freudian slip there. One of the best ones we've had, I think.
Send them on a freedom of navigation operation to the South China Sea. And he said, to vindicate our belief in the rules-based international system and the freedom of navigation through these waterways, which are absolutely vital for world trade. David, I don't even know where to begin with this. This man is off his head.
Well, quite. I mean, where do you start with this? I mean, first things first, of course, the carrier is going to be jointly run. It's not going to be, you know, forget Royal Navy. It's going to be jointly run under the existing trilateral deal that's just been signed between Britain, France and the UK. Okay. So we're going from this sort of patchwork of nations, militaries that sort of operated on their own and may have had a, you know, may have had a treaty like NATO to sort of navigate through. But we're going beyond that now. So Britain is now currently in a three-way with America and France, and that carrier will be run in a three-way deal. So it will be jointly manned, and it will be jointly crewed, and it will be jointly trained. So, you know, it won't be Royal Navy, and it's only a hair's breadth. By the sword of Damocles, there's a tiny little thread above it where it will be pennanted very quickly as the flagship for the EU Navy. And that's the direction that's going. It's not going to be operated by the Royal Navy. It can't put to sea with anything like, you know, Royal Navy picket around it as we did in the Falklands, because the stuff just isn't there. They've cut to join. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. I think this whole saga is quite remarkable. To be fair to the Royal Navy over the Queen Elizabeth at the moment. Obviously, it does take time to get a carrier out of build for people to be trained through sea trials, get it fully operational with the air wing on board. So that takes time. But Boris is talking about this carrier as if it was ready for operations now, which it's not. And the other thing which is just fascinating is if you try and see what the truth is about how many aircraft are going to be on board this ship, it appears that it's going to operate with 12 F-35s. So the boast is it's three times the size of the light carriers that we had, Invincible, Illustrious and Ark Royal. They could manage 16 Harriers at one stage in their career. And this huge ship, if it gets these aircraft at all, is going to be operating with 12. It's mind-boggling. This is not a warship. There's something else going on here. And he's talking about it more or less as if it's a political flagship to be moved around. Yep.
Yeah, quite correct. I mean, all this was covered by Admiral Sandy Woodward in 2010 and Major General Julian Thompson at the Defence Committee, where all this was submitted in a terrific paper by those two senior officers. And it was articulated more or less to what we're sort of seeing now. Some of the punchy stuff that's sort of coming out now, you know, they couldn't have seen, you know, they perhaps might have seen the master policy perspective. But those, you know, as he said, you know, I can accept change. We can all accept change, you know, and that's fine. But it needs to be for the better. And what we've got here is definitely not a change for the better for this nation. So that's your principal perspective. So, you know, I keep coming back to this, you know, and I said this at the Winchester conference. You don't need a navy. You don't need an army if you're not going to be a nation. And this is the perspective that the third sector and the circumventing that we're seeing of our MPs and Defence Committee and Parliament as a whole, because all these decisions are being made outside of that. There is no evaluation. There is no scrutiny. And, you know, to go from, you know, these squadrons of Harriers, which were tried and trusted, proven British system, all just refitted splendidly with modern equipment. And we've been them for 10 pence. We've been left with a gap for all this while. We've got rid of the through deck cruisers, illustrious, Invincible and Ark Royal. And we're left with this thing called F-35 and these great big flat tops. They're going to put 12 on there. But the American equivalents run a complete cross spectrum of all aircraft and helicopters on there. They run 100 aircraft out of them. So this is a complete load of nonsense, you know. And this F-35 is the biggest, you know, is it looks like it's going to be the biggest lame duck since I don't know when, you know. And we look back at the things that we've cancelled in our time here in Britain, and you think to yourself, well, you know, I'm going to come back to Admiral Woodward, and I'm sure Admiral Roger Lane Knott would agree with me. This is not a change for the better. This is a change for the worse.
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to do was just a little recap here. One of the reasons that there are problems on board Queen Elizabeth, as with other ships and submarines in the Royal Navy, is recruiting the retention of highly trained manpower. So we know that they hadn't got the flight deck crew to operate on Queen Elizabeth. So people were being sent off to spend time on board the French aircraft carrier to gain experience. What a state of affairs that we have to send people to the French in order to get them trained. But of course, that was the objective. So yesterday we just showed these two news clips where back in 2016, we're talking about the army being short. 2017, we're talking about the army being short and able to recruit. And of course, the firm at the centre of this was Capita. Now, while the public is not getting the truth, it doesn't take much to go and have a look on the internet to see people who do know what's going on. This is NavyNet. This is a very chatty little website where people in the military, predominantly Navy, are talking about what's going on. And in the block of text, which you can freeze and have a look on screen, they're having a dialogue about the fact that since Capita has taken over recruiting, everything is falling apart. And they eventually say, why doesn't the government just ditch this company and let's go back to the old days when the old system worked? So this is comment from people who've served. These are people who know what they're talking about. And they are pointing out that we've got a company now employed, which is not improving matters. It's taking the Navy into chaos. This is deliberate, David. This is not accident or incompetent in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. By deed or effect. I mean, these people can't be that inept, can they?
Well, I don't think so.
It's a nonsense. You've got a conflict of interest, you know, and once again, we come back to this, you know, where's the evaluation? Where's the reaction speed to evaluate this? This should have been nipped in the bud quite some time ago. Yeah. But of course, it's been allowed to continue because, of course, there is another agenda.
There's another agenda. Let's have a look at this one. This is from a couple of days ago. It's one of the Plymouth local papers. Here's the headline: HMS Torbay, that's a nuclear submarine. Rumours are denied by the Ministry of Defence. And what have they denied? Well, basically, the submarine's recently decommissioned. It's come back into Plymouth. But this is the trouble. The Ministry of Defence has been forced to refute suggestions that the ageing boat, which has been in service for 32 years, has been decommissioned because of a manpower shortage. Now, I'm going to show you the government denying this. But one of the things about living in a military town is the gossip soon goes round. And of course, what has been talked about for years is the fact that the Navy has been unable to cope with existing manning levels. They've had trouble recruiting, but much more importantly, senior people, senior engineers, critical people such as nuclear engineers have been leaving They haven't been able to replace them, and this has meant that they've had huge problems operating the nuclear submarine fleet, including at one stage a few years ago where the word on the streets, and I fully believe that word on the streets, was that one of our nuclear submarines did not sail because the senior ratings in particular regarded the submarine as unsafe. And this was due to a combination of trouble inside the refitting complex, and also the fact that the trained staff weren't available. So the government, of course, has a different line. Let's have a look at what they've been saying. We've got Frederick Richard Penn Curzon, who the government prefers to call Lord Howe. He's Minister of State for Defence. And this is the sort of answer he gives to the accusation that we can't man the ships. Turning specifically to the decommissioning of Torbay, the suggestion that a manpower shortage led to her withdrawal from service is inaccurate.
Inaccurate?
Yes.
Not wrong.
Not wrong, but inaccurate. That's immediately what I picked up on, Mike, that you look at that word inaccurate and there's the start of the smokescreen. So he goes on, you may wish to be aware that Torbay was launched in May 1985 and entered service in February 1987, and she's recently decommissioned at the end of her planned life after 30 years service with the Royal Navy. So this is all smokescreen statement because we're trying to drift people away from the problem. Furthermore, we're investing in the new Dreadnought and Astute-class submarines to ensure that the RN remains one of the best equipped and with the resources needed to continue to defend the United Kingdom and our national interests. Well, we know, of course, that submarines are not being procured at a rate which is going to replace what is there already. And as David Ellis is just saying, of course, we're not defending the United Kingdom because what the government is putting together is an internationalist, supranationalist organisation with a unified defence system. But we'll follow it through. So basically, he's saying that the naval service has been open and honest with what they're saying, the challenges of recruitment. I've got to say this man's ignorant, or he's lying, or he's misinformed, because everybody has known about these manning problems locally for a very long time. David, this is the style of the government, isn't it? The moment somebody puts their finger on the true problem, you simply deny it and put that smokescreen up.
Correct. I've seen it time and time again. You've had it personally with Gary Streeter and anybody else that you wanted to engage. Well, you, me, anybody else that's wanted to engage on this. And I know a lot of other senior officers have picked up on this and finding it simply unacceptable. But, of course, we can't get through the wall because we just can't get this breached into mainstream media. You know, we need 20 million Brexiteers to wake up and realise that this is the key trade deal. What's going on here with our military being unified into the EU. It's not an EU army. It's our army, Navy, Air Force, Royal Marines, Special Forces, Paras, the lot, lock, stock and Her Majesty's smoking barrels, if she had any currently, are being unified into the EU. So there is no Brexit. It's complete nonsense. Okay. But I've seen this Earl Howe on his feet a couple of times when I accompanied some senior staff into the Lords. And this is exactly the modus operandi. What you get is piffle, waffle and tosh and just obfuscation and a sort of detraction from whatever. And then, of course, they throw in the jam tomorrow.
Yes, always.
The best thing. Jam tomorrow. We've got all these submarines coming on. Never mind about the fact we've just literally obliterated. It's wrong to say decimated because that's 1 in 10. Obliterated what we had to start with, which was working perfectly well. Thank you very much.
Indeed. Right. Well, I thought we'd just have a very quick look through how things have got so complicated. There was only one way to do it, which is a UK column wiring diagram. This is very simplistic, but everywhere we go to see how the Ministry of Defence runs our defences, there are private companies in the way. So if we come in through the National Cyber Security Centre, and we're going to see more of that a little bit later, we're straight into Lockheed Martin, who's got a huge finger in the pie. We've got Capita, which is mismanaging recruiting. And then we've got a host of other companies. It could be British Aerospace or it could be the French company Thales. We've got all sorts of companies, Kinetic, which have got in the way with with policy. They are driving policy, in fact. So if we take it on down, we're then locked into a variety of agreements. We've got the Franco-British agreements going on with defence. We've got agreements with the Germans. We've still got NATO creaking along in the background. We've still got the European Union. And there is no doubt that Britain is fully committed to the European Union military and its military unification. We've even got bilateral agreements now with the Japanese. And then sitting at the bottom of the pile, we've got our armed forces who can't do their job because of this huge morass above them. And if I just add a bit of weight before I come back to you, David, thank you very much to our viewer who sent this through. So we've got questions coming out to the Ministry of Defence as to how much European legislation will need to be removed in order to get us out of the EU military system. I think at the bottom it says that they estimate there's about 800 to 1,000 EU exit related statutory instruments are going to be required. This is actually telling us in very clear terms the depth to which UK has been locked into the EU system. And more importantly, it's now telling us we can't even get clear of their military because of this barbed wire of European legislation.
Yes, but of course what that's talking about is the repeal bill, which, so what it's actually saying is, you know, we are going to take 800, we're going to create 800 to 1,000 statutory instruments in order to repatriate, but to patriate European legislation. So actually, this is another lie because they've no intention of trying to disentangle. This is all about entangling deeper.
Entangling within our own law system. David, the evidence is there when people know where to look for it and when some of it is interpreted as to what it really is. But this is utter betrayal of Britain as a nation state.
Completely. It's a total betrayal. The latest stuff that David Banks at Veterans for Britain has just put out is saying, he is saying, you know, on his Twitter feed there, that we're tied in until 2022 with the EU military. So by then, the military unification process will pretty much be absolute. It will be lid on, nailed down. And to get out, Lord knows, St. George may well have to come up with some ideas as to how we're going to get out of it, because this is the big deal. You know, I've said it time and time again, you know, the military unification, military union will allow the EU to become a state because it'll have single point control of the budget, the procurement. So they will control policy. It will allow them to get a treasury. They will then tax everyone. So they will have our military. And they will tax us. So this is a double whammy.
Yep.
They get to have our cake and tax us. They become a state. We don't have our military. It's locked in there. And, of course, that's the vital component that they needed with currency union. Anybody wants to refer to it, go on to the military unification timeline on the UK column. You can see it quite clearly there in 1984. Had that confirmed from Lord Tebbit face-to-face in the Lords. This is the case,
right?
But they're refusing to talk about it.
David, let me just bring in this bit as well before we go on to Mr. Rees-Mogg. But basically, here we've got operating in Sandhurst, the International Development Group, and it's been there for some time. So it's linked in with businesses. We've got the banks involved. We've got people who are linked directly into the Tory party. But we've got this international development group that is training army officers in Sandhurst into this internationalist order. So instead of learning their job to defend the nation, they are being taught that they are actually part of the machinery to build this new rules-based international order. Mm. This is very dangerous. You've said that Jacob Rees-Mogg is talking about common sense in politics. I'm going to be a bit cynical here. Is there really somebody who can see through this stuff apart from us?
Well, we're going to have to find them. I'm not really bothered what party they're from or what their background is, but some of these MPs are going to have to start to do this. It's there, you know, and I've been told this by an admiral who used to run Trident and one or two other things. You know, it is their responsibility. There is no other way of doing this. And I've heard Jacob Rees-Mogg there at that lecture that he gave at Oxford University talking about parliamentary competence and the EU's competence of where they are taking ownership of via whatever their processes are for competence above our government. So we're finding our government is completely circumvented. It's not the government. There's something else. It's the government, you know, and Parliament is being completely moribunded in this way, because the competence lays with the EU. And this is exactly the case with the military unification, is the competence and the process lays with the EU. So what you've got is all our MPs and the current sort of media, you know, media's tranche, is they're looking sideways. They just see defence cuts. Oh, crikey, well, we haven't got the money. Oh, no, it's been tough decisions, as Sir Gerald Howe said. You know, that's a nonsense, because the money has been redirected from the master control perspective at the Bank of International Settlements with Bank of England and all the other heads there going, we're going to redirect the money. So we're going to redirect the money from this perspective to that perspective. And of course, it's like damming up or stopping a river. Where you stop the money flowing, you then see areas turning into a wasteland like Devonport. So you've got this syndrome here where Parliament, what Parliament has got to do is not look sideways and see defence cuts. Oh dear, well, it's awful, isn't it? Oh, Christ, we shouldn't be doing that, you know. No. What they've got to do is look up and go, wow, hang on a minute, what the hell is that? There's something above us that's now got control of us.
Yeah.
And the control is absolute. And that's what they have to do. They're not thinking. They're not thinking in anything like three dimensions here, either politically or financially. They're just thinking in one dimension.
Right.
And it's not good enough. And Rees-Mogg has started to use the language, and this is why I've flagged it up, is he's talking about the competence, that the EU has the competence and the control, if you want to call it that, of what's going on. And Parliament doesn't. And that's the key thing.
And you're saying they should look up to see what's coming. Yeah. And the average person on the street should be looking up to see what's coming, because, Mike, you're just about to take us into another step.
Well, exactly, because I mean, we're talking about the military becoming Europeanised. We have been talking about the British legal system, the British constitution, for many, many years. It's something which is largely misunderstood or not understood by particularly MPs. Well, the Law Commission has launched a new consultation, which is apparently going to simplify sentencing, because sentencing for criminals is just way too difficult. What they're saying is that currently the law of sentencing procedure is contained in many different acts of Parliament, dating as far back as the 14th century. It's often not clear how the acts apply, and many use outdated and inaccessible language. Because, Brian, you know, this has been a problem for hundreds of years, but now, today, this is when we're supposed to be pursuing a Brexit agenda. This is when we're going to change this.
Yeah,
this is when we're going to do it. So the timing is all important here. Why are they looking at this now? So they say that they've published plans today, which do not affect current maximum or minimum sentences for criminal offences, nor replace the work of the Sentencing Council, but they are aiming to offer a technical fix to modernise the law, bringing greater transparency and improved efficiency there. So they're going to codify in a European style the sentencing procedures for criminal offences, and going to bring those bang up to date. And they're going to throw away our constitutional position in the process. So this consultation was launched at midnight this morning. And it's open until the 26th of January 2018. And it's another case where I think people with any kind of responsibility need to be paying attention and contributing to this, because it looks to me like they intend to throw the baby out with the bathwater, with a view to making, once again, another part of the British legal system compatible with that of continental Europe.
Yeah, and within a highly IT-based system.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So let's follow on through that. And this was something that just I'm going to say, almost jumped out at us today. The National Cyber Security Centre. Now, we've covered this before. We've been warning about what's been going on here, but we think we have something truly astonishing. Let's remind ourselves, the NCSC is open and accessible, it says. We work collaboratively with other government agency and departments, law enforcement, defence, UK intelligence, security agencies and our international partners. But don't worry, we recognise diversity and different perspectives, etc. Well, let's get in a bit deeper to this wonderful organisation. Intrigued to see some of this cartoon-like networking. This is often a sign of, I'll call it, the other side working. And why were we interested in this? Well, we came across this man, Technical Director Ian Levy. Here he is. And this is what he had to say. Our strategy, the strategy, is to use government as a guinea pig for all the measures we want to see done at national level. I was just stunned when I read this. So this organisation says it's going to use government of the nation as a guinea pig for the measures that they want to see done on a national scale. This is dangerous stuff, Mike.
Who are they?
Well, they is simply the organisation that forms this new cybersecurity unit, of which this man is one of the directors.
These are private companies?
Well, as we're going to see, as we take a look at these people and who they are and who they're working with, it's difficult to tell who they are. The best way we could do this, I had to take a little film clip, but to track down Ian Levy himself, I came in through this government-organised talk that took place last year. Let's have a look at some of the people here. It's just astonishing. You have consultancy firms, you have GCHQ, you have people involved with the Cabinet Office. The lady with Northrop Grumman there is boasting about training school children. You have people from Honeywell, you've got people from universities, you've got cybersecurity people. It just goes on and on. Price Waterhouse is there. Repeated a number of times.
So this mush of private and public, can't even describe it as, well, maybe collaboration is the right word.
Collaboration is the right word, Mike.
So this mush of public and private collaboration is now going to use government systems as the guinea pig for their cybersecurity. That, of course, means they're going to be interfacing with government systems, including every possible level of personal information, tax records, medical records.
Absolutely.
So this is hugely dangerous.
So they're going to use government. They don't mean they're going to use government. What they mean is they're going to use governmental access to public data in order to trial out their systems and where they're heading. So if we just switch to one of these ladies, I just pulled out this particular lady because I was interested. She's related to the Cabinet Office, Emma Warham. And Emma's apparently spent most of her career as an information specialist in the MOD. What has she actually done to improve defence? I don't know. But including exploring, quote, the role of trust in information sharing. And that's part of her PhD. So she's not even fully qualified. She's using this to train herself. But she's known for working across the MOD, promoting information assurance and risk best practice. I'm going to say, I think she's sucking up mod budget, but what is she actually producing? I've no idea. She specialises apparently privately in stained glass windows.
Well, they're pretty transparent.
Or not.
We have heard many people in recent weeks from various organisations discussing the use of public personal data belonging to the public, which is in the hands of government, and being somewhat lax about their respect for that.
Yes.
And in fact, one, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but
from
one
from a university, I know,
yes,
the lady, yeah,
in particular, saying that really the Information Commissioner and the Data Protection Act just getting in the way of what they want to do.
Yeah.
So this is particularly dangerous. And once, of course, once people's personal information gets out into all kinds of private organizations. Then, of course, the security of that personal information, it's not just government systems that then become potential target for hackers, but it's every system that belongs to these third-party companies as well. We then lose control of all our personal information.
Yeah.
I think everybody should be able to see the problems with that.
Yeah. David, just 30 seconds to close.
This looks like the cure for democracy, doesn't it? This is what the recipe is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you've got to look at the original sort of founding of how the computing and digital world began, right there from Gordon Welshman and Alan Turing at Hut 6, and follow it all the way through. And it won't take people a great deal of effort to join all that up. But what you're seeing here really is the culmination of what Gordon Welshman was warning of.
Yeah.
Right here. In front of us, because this is entrenched now in Whitehall, in the Cabinet Office, and what you've got effectively there is a shadow government. They're unelected, and they are busily beavering away, doing Lord knows what, and making comments like, we're going to use government as a guinea pig for their agenda. I couldn't think of anything more repugnant. I think this needs an outcry, and it needs an outcry quickly, but it just needs the sufficient numbers of the British people to see what's going on here to do any good with it.
Absolutely. We'll end on that note, David. Thank you very
much. It's to start doing their job.
Indeed. David, thank you very much for joining us. That is the note to end on, that once we can see the problem, once we can see how we're being attacked, it's up to us to expose it and to start demanding action to stop it. Most of that, of course, is our own action, because if we say nothing and do nothing, this is going to continue to come in. But I think it's becoming quite obvious that despite all the claims of the Tory government under Theresa May that we're leaving the EU, that is not happening. What is actually happening is that the EU system of government is being spread by stealth right the way through our government structure and the civil service. So we'll leave it there. We've shown you what's happening. We'll encourage all of our viewers and listeners to get out there talking to other people and, of course, pointing a finger and exposing the people responsible for doing this. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.